Paul Kingsnorth. I'll pass him around. Someone in the other group said he would look better if he cut his hair. And I said, as a matter of fact, he's done the opposite. His hair is shoulder length now. He's got a full beard. So Paul Kingsnorth is British. He was born in Worcester in the United Kingdom. 10 bonus points if you know where Worcester is. I didn't know myself. I guess it's northwest of Oxford, going toward the Lake District, if that means anything. But that's where he's from. He studied he was born in 1972. So he's a young'un. 45 now. He studied history at Oxford, and very early on wanted a career as a writer. So he started writing poetry and journalistic type of writing, and was also an environmentalist. So he got connected with Greenpeace and was an editor for Greenpeace, for their British editions, and then joined up with the magazine The Ecologist, which is the leading British environmental magazine. He was an editor there. By 2003, he was ready to come out with his own book, and he wrote about the anti-globalization movements that were very prominent at that point. If you recall the famous Battle of Seattle in 1999 and other big protests in other parts of the world against the World Trade Organization and the whole globalization juggernaut. So he was interested in that. He came out with a book on that. But he was beginning to lose faith in environmentalism. Even though he was very active in it, he was starting to realize it's not really working. We're not solving these problems. So he was beginning to wonder. And then the big economic crash hit in 2008. And for him, that was a wake-up call. That was an indication that things really are starting to fall apart. This is the beginning of something much bigger. So in 2009, he and a colleague named Dugald Hine, H-I-N-E, published a manifesto that they called Uncivilization, the Dark Mountain Manifesto. There's a lot of darkness in his writings. He talks about dark ecology as well. But this manifesto, and we'll get into the details of it, but it began a series of publications, which they have been doing ever since. I think it comes out twice a year, and it's a collection of essays, poetry, photography, and art of reimagining civilization. Their premise is that it's up to the artists to give voice to a worldview. How do we think about our place in the world and what constitutes a decent society? That writers and artists need to express that, and that we can no longer rely on the worldview or the mythology of industrial modernism, that's on its way out. So Kingsnorth is similar to a lot of the writers we've been looking at, and in fact he's influenced by a lot of them. So you may recall that a recent book that is a collection of Wendell Berry's essays, it's called The World Ending Fire.
I noticed he just put out a new one.
Wendell Berry, yeah, he's got a new one, yes. He keeps cranking them out. But The World Ending Fire was a collection of the best work by Wendell Berry, selected by Paul Kingsnorth. Kingsnorth was the editor of that volume. Chelsea Green, our local publisher here in White River Junction, just came out with a collection of writings from the Dark Mountain Project. So they took, again, Kingsnorth edited what he thought were the leading writings from the past, what's it been now, 8 years of Dark Mountain.
Dark Mountain is just English, right? It's mostly English writers and whatever. I mean,
Oh, British, you mean?
British, I mean.
Yeah.
British.
Not like English language.
No.
I think so. I think they're open to other. I mean, there are American. Right, Greer has had an essay in it, and probably others as well. But it is published in Britain. But Chelsea Green came out with this collection of Dark Mountain essays. It's called Walking on Lava. And that just came out. Kingsnorth's publisher wouldn't allow him to have his own writings in that collection. I don't understand the politics of that, but he did write the introduction. So that's an intriguing book. And then Kingsnorth's most recent book is Confessions of a Recovering Environmentalist. And I'm going to read a selection from that a little later. This just came out recently as well. He has continued to write fiction, and his novel called The Wake was published in 2014 and was up for the Man Booker Prize, which is a major award for British literature. And then he recently came out with another novel as well. In 2014, he took his family to a self-sufficient homestead in Ireland. And like Wendell Berry, a lot of his writing now reflects his experience on the farm. And
so he's still there. He's still there in Ireland.
Yes, yes. He currently lives on this farm in Ireland. He came to the U.S. just a couple months ago, and he gave a workshop at the Roe Center in Roe, Massachusetts, which is not far from here. It's in Western Mass. And I was hoping to make it to that, but we didn't. Would have gotten to meet him. But so he's still out there advocating and talking with people, but he's primarily a writer.
How do you spell Roe?
R-O-W-E. It's off Route 2 near Williamstown, Adams, that area. All right, so I'm going to read a few passages from the Dark Mountain Manifesto, from Uncivilization. So this comes from 2009. Human civilization is an intensely fragile construction. It is built on little more than belief. Once that belief begins to crumble, the collapse of a civilization may become unstoppable. Old gods are rearing their heads, and old answers, revolution, war, ethnic strife. Politics as we have known it totters like the machine it was built to sustain. In its place could easily arise something more elemental with a dark heart. Now, he's not talking specifically about our current president, because this was written 8 years ago, but he's got the idea here. So what they're saying is that as the myth of progress begins to lose its meaning, its value for us, which is what Greer is arguing, our civilization is not going to continue. That's the myth that sustains us. That's the worldview that gives modern industrial civilization its energy, its raison d'être, right? That's reason for being. And as that falls apart, people are going to desperately look for something to replace it. So Kingsnorth and his fellow Dark Mountaineers are not advocating for ethnic conflict or white supremacy or religious fundamentalism, but they're saying that's what we're going to get when the Enlightenment mythology starts to lose its hold. The myth of progress starts to lose its hold. People are going to find these darker elemental ideologies to take their place. And so the goal of the Dark Mountain Project is to come up with an alternative to that, come up with something that does respond to the breakdown of progress and of our civilization, but is a more positive and nurturing worldview, not to this dark elemental stuff. But he says we have to understand why that is. We can't just reject the darkness and reject the these other responses because they're coming from an authentic place. We have to understand why people are drawn to these. And here's a quote again. We are the first generations to grow up surrounded by evidence that our attempt to separate ourselves from nature has been a grim failure. We tried ruling the world. We tried acting as God's steward. Then we tried ushering in the human revolution, the age of reason and isolation. We failed in all of it, and our failure destroyed more than we were even aware of. Any pushback on that? Any comment on that? In response to that, Kingsnorth and Hine came up with what they call the 8 principles of uncivilization. Number 1, we live in a time of social, economic, and ecological unraveling. All around us are signs that our whole way of living is already passing into history. We will face this reality honestly and learn how to live with it. That's their first premise. And I think that's what is the common thread in all of these authors, is let's honestly face what we see happening here and not sweep it under the rug. Not
social, economical, and whatever.
And ecological. Ecological unraveling. And when he says our way of living is passing into history, that brings to mind Greer's phrase that we're sliding down the chute into the dustbin of history, or the compost bin of history. So Kingsnorth is making the same point. Principle number 2, we reject the faith which holds that the converging crises of our times can be reduced to a set of problems, and that's in quotation marks, in need of technological or political solutions, in quotation marks. And again, that echoes Greer, who said, we're not dealing with problems, we're dealing with a predicament. So we're not going to solve them one by one. We have to change our entire way of life. 3.
Sorry, would you read that again? We reject the faith.
We reject the faith which holds that the converging crises of our times can be reduced to a set of problems, in quotation marks, in need of technological or political solutions. And solutions is also in quotation marks. Principle number 3, we intend to challenge the stories which underpin our civilization, the myth of progress, the myth of human centrality, and the myth of our separation from nature. By human centrality, he's echoing Jensen, of course, right, who writes about human supremacy. Number 4, we will reassert the role of storytelling as more than mere entertainment. It is through stories that we weave reality. Are not the point and purpose of the planet. Our art will begin with the attempt to step outside the human bubble. Which means the fiction that they write will not solely concern itself with human conflict and social conflict, but will address our place in nature and our relationship with other species. 6, we will celebrate writing and art which is grounded in a sense of place and of time. Our literature has been dominated for too long by those who inhabit the cosmopolitan citadels. And that brings to mind Wendell Berry, who started out in New York and decided very quickly that he needed to get out and ground his work in a real place. Well, New York is a real place, but...
No.
Seven, we will not lose ourselves in the elaboration of theories or ideologies. Our words will be elemental. We will write with dirt under our fingernails. And eight, and this is an important one, the end of the world as we know it is not the end of the world, full stop. Together we will find the hope beyond hope, the paths which lead to the unknown world ahead of us. And this, we can see a further commentary on this. Kingsnorth was interviewed recently by the Boston Review, who asked him, how did it feel when you accepted the end of the world? Relief or despair? And Kingsnorth's answer was, I'd make an important distinction between the end of the world and the end of the way we're living now. It's the latter that's ending. What do I feel about that? Kind of both. More relief, actually. There's a common notion among activists that taking action must be inherently hopeful. If you're going on demonstrations or working to stop climate change, then that's a hopeful or optimistic thing. But after a while, when people realize they're banging their heads against a brick wall, this kind of campaigning leads to despair. What I found when I said, you know what, this isn't going to work, was that a great weight lifted off my shoulders. I've stopped pretending that the impossible is possible. So he's reached the conclusion that trying to fix the current civilization, and that mainstream environmentalism is an effort to do that, is just not going to work, and he's surrendering to the despair in that. But then saying that there's something beyond that. If we give up our way of life, if we're willing to let it all go, there is something beyond that. And we are going to imagine that. We're going to envision that through our art. Not that it's going to be easy or fun to go through that transition. I don't think he ever says that. It's certainly going to be difficult. But we can hold on to our highest human values while we navigate this shift. That's what his work is about. So then he talks about his... Yes, sure. Walking through a museum. So you've got these rooms with all this art from, say, 1200 to 1500, right? And what are they concerned with? It's all religious art, right? It's all religious myths. That was the culture, that was the civilization that they inhabited. Mm-hmm. And then something changed, and the art changed. Mm-hmm. And when you think of the art of the early 20th century, or the modernist, abstract, what is that saying? Mm-hmm. And then decorative, I don't know if you call it decorative or art attuned to nature, that's saying something. That's like, why aren't you painting crucifixion scenes? No, I mean, it sounds kind of ridiculous, yeah. But it's like, art, so the question then is, is the art just reflecting where the civilization is, or is there a sense in which those artists are giving people a story like, oh yeah, that's what's real. That's the world I live in. I recognize that.
Or is this the world we could live in? Mm-hmm.
The world we could live in.
Well, maybe he's advocating for maybe that's what artists should be doing, is making clarity about what we should be doing, or how we should be seeing or being. I recognize that art in itself is a spokesperson for a time. And back when they were painting the crucifixion or whatever, was the central focus. Religion was a central focus and a controlling factor in people's lives, and there isn't. Now there's none. I mean, now it's a floating time.
What it does contribute to this is articulating and possibly criticizing the fundamental assumptions of culture. that's his positive contribution to the environmental problematic that we're in. Different society, and that seems to be not on the agenda right now.
What's the difference
between... Reflects a little bit on his background. And he's in this quote, he's going to refer to the current turmoil, and he's referring specifically to Trump and to Brexit and to the far-right movements in Europe. The sense of the uniqueness of places and of the cultures that sprang from them had been what pushed me towards green activism in the first place. From a young age, I had an inchoate sense that much of the world's color, beauty, and distinctiveness was being bulldozed away in the name of money and progress. Some old magic, some connection was being snuffed out in the process. What is driving the current turmoil is threats to identity, culture, and meaning. Waves of migration, multicultural policies, eroding borders, shifting national and ethnic identities, ongoing globalist attacks on dead white men, and Western culture, all that is solid is melting into air. Who can promise the return of that solidity? Not the left, which long ago hitched its wagon to the globalist horse, enthusing about breaking down everything from gender identities to national borders, and painting any dissent as prejudice or hatred. Instead, a new nationalism has risen to the occasion. So you get what he's saying there. He's it's in the wake of Brexit and
can you paraphrase the point he's making?
Right. I was leading up to it earlier when I said that when the dominant myth that the glue, as Andy said, that holds a culture together, when that starts to disintegrate, people are going to scramble and grab onto whatever they can find that's going to give them meaning. So he's saying that with this globalist, we're going to see later today that Vandana Shiva calls it the monoculture of the mind, but globalization wipes out local cultural differences. It wipes out identities that people have had for generations.
Wow. Well, right? The landscape is doing it now.
Right. So people will desperately reassert their identities, whether that's being white or being American as opposed to an immigrant, being Christian.
Picking up a gun at Walmart, picking up a gun somewhere else.
Yeah, yeah.
But
so he's saying
also what the left has been pushing to change.
And he's saying that that's not going to work because remember, he himself is coming from a leftist or progressive background. He has impeccable credentials, right? He wrote for The Ecologist and Greenpeace. And he's saying, it's not working, folks.
He's just to insist that we're all alike doesn't work.
That's right. That's right. The more you push this universalist, globalist, enlightenment set of values and say we're all one big happy family and just let go of your hateful right-wing ideology, you're just pushing people more into that corner. You've brought up the lecture I gave about John Gray, and it's a similar critique. It's saying that this enlightenment urge to unify everything and to have universal values is not going to work because people need their local identity. They need their sense of connection to their own community and their own place in the world. And so the Enlightenment agenda is failing us. That's what he's saying here.
And yet, its purpose is to...
Benson and many of these other authors is saying that a lot of the struggle that we see, a lot of the brutal ideologies, a lot of the violence, don't come from human nature. You don't see that in tribal cultures. it comes directly from our worldview, our modernist way of being in the world, which is all about individualism and competition and wealth and hoarding and all the rest of that, all the things we've been talking about, that is what shapes human beings to being so, so much what Eisler calls a dominator personalities, right? So it's not about the left or progressive values saying, okay, we're gonna redecorate modern culture. We're going to get rid of all this bad stuff and bring in good stuff. The problem is the culture itself. You can't fix it. That's what these guys are saying. So if you go past this worldview, which has separated us from nature and separated us from small, intimate communities, you will find another aspect of human nature that thrives and does not turn to this kind of murderous ideology and violence. Sure, there are tribal rivalries. None of these authors are saying that hunter-gatherer societies are completely nonviolent and completely generous to each other. It's not utopian, but it's a heck of a lot better than the global destruction that our current worldview has brought about. Now, can we get there? Can we get back to that after we've been living with civilization for all these centuries? That's the big question. That's a tall order to do that. But
obviously, there have to be a lot less
words. As ever, those who can harness people's deep, old attachment to place and identity, to a belonging and a meaning that goes beyond money or argument, will win the day. This might be as iron a law as any human history can provide. I think now that globalism is the rootless ideology of the fossil fuel age, and it will fade with it. But the angry nationalisms which currently challenge it offer us no better answers about how to live well with the natural world, which we have made into an enemy. Our oldest identity is one that still holds us in its grip, whether we know it or not. Like the fox in the garden or the bird in the tree, we are all animals in a place. If we have a future, cultural or ecological, and they are the same thing in the end, it will begin with a quality of attention and a defense of loved things.
Where is that from?
This is from an essay. I didn't take down the title of the essay, but it's on his website, paulkingsnorth.net.
And defense of loved things.
And like these other authors, he's saying the alternative is to reclaim our animal identity, our biological connection with nature, and to celebrate that, not to push ourselves away from that and to over-civilize ourselves so that we can't experience that connection anymore.
Ron, yep. So love things
are... I was Kingsnorth really wrestling with it too. I don't think that he believes he's found the answer. This is from his essay called Dark Ecology. I'm just going to read passages from this and we'll talk about it. I've recently begun reading the collected writings of Theodore Kaczynski.
You mean old Ted?
Old Ted. I'm worried that it may change my life. Some books do that from time to time, and this is beginning to shape up as one of them. It's not that Kaczynski, who is a fierce, uncompromising critic of the techno-industrial system, is saying anything I haven't heard before. I've heard it all before, many times. By his own admission, his arguments are not new, but the clarity with which he makes them and his refusal to obfuscate are refreshing. I seem to be at a point in my life where I am open to hearing this again. I don't know quite why. Here are the four premises with which he begins the book. 1, technological progress is carrying us to inevitable disaster. 2, only the collapse of modern technological civilization can avert disaster. 3, the political left is technological society's first line of defense against revolution. 4. What is needed is a new revolutionary movement dedicated to the elimination of technological society. That's his summary of Kaczynski. Then he goes on, Kaczynski's prose is sparse and his arguments logical and unsentimental, as you might expect from a former mathematics professor. I have a tendency towards sentimentality around these issues, so I appreciate his discipline. The way that the four arguments are being filled out is worryingly convincing. I say worrying because I do not want to end up agreeing with Kaczynski. There are two reasons for this. First, if I do end up agreeing with him and with other such critics I've been exploring recently, such as Jacques Ellul and D.H. Lawrence and C.S. Lewis and Ivan Illich, I am going to have to change my life in quite profound ways, not just in the ways I've already changed it, getting rid of my telly, not owning a credit card, avoiding smartphones and e-readers, growing at least some of my own food, learning practical skills, fleeing the city, etc., but properly, deeply, I am still embedded, at least partly because I can't work out where to jump or what to land on, or whether you can ever get away by jumping, or simply because I'm frightened to close my eyes and walk over the edge. I'm writing this on a laptop computer, by the way. It has a broadband connection and all sorts of fancy capabilities I've never tried or wanted to use. I mainly use it for typing. You might think this makes me a hypocrite, and you might be right. But there's a more interesting observation you could make. This, says Kaczynski, is where we all find ourselves, until and unless we choose to break out. In his own case, he explains, he had to go through a personal psychological collapse as a young man before he could escape what he saw as his chains. And then there's a long quote from Kaczynski, which I'm not going to go into. But he summarizes how Kaczynski moved to a small cabin in the woods of Montana to get away from technological society. But it didn't take him long to learn that such an escape, if it was ever possible, is not possible now. More cabins were built in his woods. Roads were enlarged. Loggers buzzed through the forests. More planes passed overhead. One day in August 1983, Kaczynski set out hiking toward his favorite wild place and found, then he quotes Kaczynski again, he found that they had put a road right through the middle of it. This is Kaczynski's words now. You just can't imagine how upset I was. It was from that point on I decided that rather than trying to acquire further wilderness skills, I would work at getting back at the system. Revenge. And then Kingsnorth takes it up again. I can identify with pretty much every word of this, including sometimes the last one. This is the other reason that I do not want to end up being convinced by Kaczynski's position. Ted Kaczynski was known to the FBI as the Unabomber during the 20 years in which he sent parcel bombs from his shack to those he deemed responsible for the promotion of the technological society he despises. In those two decades, he killed 3 people and injured 23 others. He nearly brought down an airplane. Unlike many other critics of the technosphere who are busy churning out books and doing the lecture circuit and updating their anarcho-primitivist websites, Kaczynski wasn't just theorizing about being a revolutionary. He meant it, which is, all right, once you accept that that things really are falling apart, that things really are at this place, and industrial technological society is the problem, now what? Now what do you do?
Well, don't we always look to history? Haven't we always gone to history? I mean, something
earlier about John Brown, and you could compare Theodore Kaczynski to John Brown.
Right.
Sort of a modern day, and the question for both of them, I guess, is how do you How do you look at them? Are they crazy or simply murderous or not?
Glenn Barbour.